Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the Fireside Room, Jane Stroll is speaking on ecumenism, the Episcopal Church. So let's listen in.
Episcopalians and Lutherans are sort of shared ministers and shared, and in fact,
liturgy is the same.
In fact, the uproar around this agreement, it's one of these funny situations where people feel like they were doing absolutely fine ecumenically until there had to be some kind of formal official addressing of it. And if they just left it alone, probably would have been better. Because then when it came to division, you see, people who'd already entered into it were caught in the middle. And that's where I say that this whole thing of ecumenism happens at different levels and at different paces. Yeah, but the other thing, let me say about we call them Episcopalians in this country, but they are part of the Anglican Communion. They are another group then that is worldwide. They are certainly not answerable to the Archbishop of Canterbury in the way that feudal Catholics look at themselves as answerable to the Pope. But they are in communion and they take this very seriously. So we are talking then about a church. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of Anglicans are persons of color. This is always because of the British Empire in the continent of Africa. So, for example, Bishop Desmond Tutu is an Anglican bishop. So, you have to think it is a wider picture than we know. And in fact, the historic piece, the English, the Anglican Church per se, Anglican being from Angles and Saxons, is probably the least vital piece of it. I mean, as a state church, attendance and everything in England is pretty poor, which is much like the Lutheran state churches in Scandinavia. But the English, the Anglican Church has always understood itself in many ways as it is a middle road. They're neither Catholic nor strictly Protestant in terms of how they saw themselves at the time of the Reformation. And they're an interesting piece too because they really did begin as a national church. Henry VIII, this is probably the most comical story. My students always get these people right because they, you know, they really capture your eye. I wonder how many of my women students had those Peggy Nesbitt dolls. Do you remember those fancy dolls of the wives of Henry, you know, you get line them up? How many of them had them? I have a wonderful dish towel that has the line of kings, you know. Moving on, that when I'm teaching this section, I always use it to revive my memory as to what family ruled when and how they unfolded. Henry VIII was of the English ruling family of the Tudors, T-U-D-O-R. And it was his father who really secured the family's claim to the throne. This comes at the end of the Wars of the Roses, of a period of civil war in England. So understand the stakes of a steady monarch on the throne and a family that would inherit was very important to everyone. That they not descend back into the kind of conflict they had known. So Henry succeeds his father. He is married to he was not the first, Arthur was the firstborn son. Arthur is betrothed to Catherine, a princess of Aragon, a Spanish princess, okay, a Roman Catholic. Obviously, at that time, so were the English. She is also, for political reasons, this is important to know, she is the aunt of the man who becomes the Emperor of Germany, of Charles V. Yes, yes. And is she is then a daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella. And her sister is his mother. So, Arthur dies before he takes the throne. And this is not a matter of true romance, this is a matter of political wisdom. And so the interest was to form an alliance between the Tudor household and the Habsburgs. That part of this. And so, Henry is then betrothed to his brother's widow, to Catherine. They marry, they have one surviving child. A daughter named Mary, later on to be called Bloody Mary, but they're Tudors. Now, there are other pregnancies, but she's the only one who survives. Now, you have a couple of factors coming together here. England is, of the countries in Europe, in many ways, England has a fascinating history of a rebellious streak. This is where John Wycliffe is from. You have a group called the Lollards. There have been tensions between England and the Roman hierarchy for quite some time. So there's kind of a native stream of reform, and then there's all this stuff coming over from the continent. Right. So you have this ferment. People said, well, what if Henry had been happily married? Well, there still would have been a Reformation in England, I think is the point. But its contours would have been different. So there are Protestant sensibilities boiling away. There's a group, one of my favorite, who met in a place called the White Horse Tavern, known as the Hot Gospelers. Isn't that a great one? Who sat around and talked about Protestant ideas. So that is there already. Then, added to it, Henry is concerned about the fact that he has no male heir, and that clearly Catherine is not going to produce one. Now, how much, I should rephrase that. She probably didn't produce one because of Henry's problems. But that it looks like Henry had syphilis, actually, and so his reproductive capacities were limited. But that wasn't the kind of thing you suggested to a monarch, I suppose, at the time. Anyway, in the meantime, so Henry, now he raises the question of whether he is, because he has taken his brother's widow, that he has violated Old Testament law and canon law, and that the curse upon it was the childlessness, or the loss of successive children. And I mean, it's hard to say how seriously Henry entertained that, but this was certainly an age where people believed that. So then in addition to it, he has fallen in love with a member of his wife's entourage, Anne Boleyn. So Henry wants his marriage to Catherine, wants a divorce, but basically what he'd get would be sort of a legitimate dissolution that would leave him in good standing with the church. Now, one of my advisors in graduate school made, I thought, a fascinating comparison. He said, in some ways, Henry and Martin Luther have something in common. And one of them is that both of them, in their own positions, played by the rules of the system. Luther as a monk, Henry as a loyal monarch. Right? Loyal to the church, and their expectations were that in their hour of need, the system would respond and take care of them, and they were both bitterly disappointed in different ways. Henry wants this marriage dissolved. This was not unheard of. Of course, the church had to accommodate the needs of the ruling families of Europe on many occasions so that they could make marriages. So Henry figures this can be done. His timing was terrible. Because what happens is he turns to the papacy to do this. Cardinal Wolsey is, here is this point that they call greatest institutional interpenetration. Cardinal Wolsey is precisely that, a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church. He's also the Chancellor of England, right? Cardinal Wolsey should be able to take care of this. But the problem is that in 1527, Charles V, who is tired of the recalcitrance of the Pope, has sacked Rome and virtually holds the Pope a prisoner. This is not the time to allow the King of England to throw over the Emperor's aunt. Right? It just, right? So it's not a convenient time to ask. And there's another issue at stake. When Henry married Catherine, he asked for and received a sort of exemption that the church could grant, legitimizing the union. If they now turn around and say, well, I guess he shouldn't have married her, it's not pleasing to God, they undercut their own authority. So on two grounds, they are unwilling to act to help Henry. And so what he begins, scholars believe what Henry begins to do, is put the screws to the Pope. And the best way to put the screws to him is to take away his money and interfere with his authority in England. And that what they think is at the beginning, Henry felt if he pushed hard enough, the Pope would knuckle under. And then when he didn't, Henry finally says, well, I might as well just go on and sever the connection. So what you have in England is a series of parliamentary acts where piece by piece, Henry essentially keeps the structure that's existing, and he just cuts off the top of the pyramid. that where it used to be, at the top of the pyramid, was the judiciary courts around the Roman Pope and the Pope himself. Now Henry just says, nothing goes out of here, nothing goes out of England. We'll have our own ecclesiastical courts in England, we'll have our own Archbishop of Canterbury. And so Henry really understands himself to have a Catholic Church apart from obedience to Rome. Now, you can imagine, for the Pope, this is a very dangerous definition. You know, he wants to say there is no such thing as a Catholic Church apart from obedience to Rome. These two things are identical. And he's got to worry because, see, the political time is interesting. We always think the Pope was so in control. The Pope really had to negotiate things with these rulers. Remember, as I say, when he irritated the emperor came down and conquered Rome. This hardly seems the action of a loyal Roman Catholic. I mean, Charles was a devout Roman Catholic, but he was pissed off at the way, politically, the Pope was negotiating his relationship with Charles and the King of France. What, of course, the Pope has to worry about is if one monarch says, maybe we can be Catholic, and just cut the Pope out. What would keep the King of France from doing that? What would keep the Emperor from doing that? It sets a very dangerous precedent. And in that respect, it's what makes it important, because England as a country at this point is still kind of a backwater. I mean, in terms of political clout, the Emperor, the Pope wasn't that worried about losing him. But in terms of the model, the role model that he was given, this is dangerous.
So what do you do? As he cut off and makes the okay. Church.
What he does,
same idea, but obedience.
Without obedience to Rome, he generally carries this through by in Parliament. They act fiduciary. It's very interesting what they cut back first, what will be paid out. Won't allow the usual fees that were paid to Rome to be paid. Another place,
still paid to the church, but not to Rome.
Not to Rome. The piece that shows up too is in the question of judicial matters. And this is one of the things that really kept Rome cooking, was the fact that this was always the last word of appeal. So all sorts of cases dealing with who should inherit what position in the church, who made a right claim to this priestly office or that one, or who could marry whom. If you were dissatisfied with the decisions at the local levels, your final court of appeal is wrong. What Henry does is act to restrain appeals. And it's interesting, he declares both his appeal to Rome illegitimate and Catherine's appeal to Rome illegitimate. Okay? So that basically they had taken their marital case there. Henry cuts that off, says it will be settled in the English courts. And of course, his Archbishop of Canterbury is willing to grant him a divorce. So it's in matters then of, the other thing is ecclesiastical law. One of the first steps that Henry takes is to say that there will be no new statutes enacted in England without the approval of the monarch, and that a committee appointed by him will then revise the standing. Now you see here, this sort of division of who has control of ecclesiastical law. Priests and such were not tried in the courts of the country. They were under, so now here's Henry interfering again, and he has himself named the supreme head of the church in England as far as the law of Christ allows. Now, Henry does not assume sacerdotal or priestly duties. He does not ordain, he does not celebrate the sacraments, and it isn't like he's got his finger in every pie. He has an ecclesiastical structure, but the monarch is the final word.
So if he was doing this to the stuff, well, it's going to be in your hands.
Yes, Thomas Cranmer is named his Archbishop of Canterbury. He already has a convocation of clergy, but on big issues, he is involved. And all of this, you see, goes through Parliament. So then the important acts he has to involve then are the recognition of his position, the recognition of the dissolution of his marriage, the recognition of the legitimacy of his marriage to Anne. Now, Anne is already pregnant, and he has actually married her. Now he has to get acknowledgement of her position as queen and the legitimacy of her offspring. And Mary, then, you see, is pushed aside. Yes?
How long is
it? Well, it's a period from about 1527, say, 1535. But not that many when you think about it. You know, call it a decade. There's some very. And the other thing he moves to do is dissolve the monasteries. See, and then the state is taking to itself these church properties.
And that's lots.
He calls it. He calls them together. Yes, and actually, one of the things I haven't done as much work on the English Reformation. But it is striking that, by and large, people went along with this, and that's because there was a lot of resentment against Rome. There were many people who shed no tears about this, but there were also people who did. Right? And so you have a certain number of the nobility, especially, that do rebel. It doesn't go without some conflict, but by and large, it moves pretty quickly. Now, when Henry's serious advice. He marries Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn bears him a daughter, Elizabeth, who becomes Elizabeth I. Then Anne Boleyn is tried and executed for treason. I think treason consisted of his suspicions of adultery at the time. Well, I mean, a monarch is a monarch, you know. And then he marries Jane Seymour, who is of the English nobility, and she bears him a son, Edward. Then Jane Seymour dies. She's a infernal health. So is Edward. But she dies rather early. Now, there's an interesting piece. His next wife is Anne of Cleves. She's a German princess. Anne is the sister, actually, of the elect. Well, what it is Luther's prince is married to one sister, and the other one is Anne. All right, so what we're saying here is a Protestant connection. Now, what we know is that as Henry felt sort of in peril politically, there was a period of time where he felt throwing his lot in with the Protestant princes would be wise. And then, theologically, he bends a little more to Protestant doctrine. I'm not clear exactly what happened, but he and Anne despised each other on sight. And so she went back to Germany. The person who was responsible for the match paid for it dearly. And Henry then sort of returned. Theologically, he's more Catholic in his leanings, in terms of his doctrine of the sacrament and such. So when he then is married twice more, he dies. The last of his wives outlives him. There are two Catherines then that follow. Catherine Howard, who was also executed, and Catherine Parr. Yeah, who does see. And interestingly, like, through all this, Catherine of Aragon and her daughter Mary are still living. They live in seclusion. The daughter Mary is raised as a Catholic. But that means when Henry dies, you have three children. Edward succeeds him as a son. Edward is Protestant in his leanings. He is of minority age, so he has two protectors, both of whom are Protestant in their sympathy. So England takes a sharp turn. It's more Protestant teaching and practice. Thomas Cranmer, who has been the Archbishop of Canterbury, probably best known for the Book of Common Prayer, is writing that what you have here is a church that really gets its identity from its liturgy. Lutherans make snide remarks often about what Episcopal theology. Well, there is, of course, one. But what this church in England realizes, all they had to do is look at the divisions on the continent, particularly around the issue of the Lord's Supper. We talked, those of you who were yesterday, about the kind of memorial, symbolic presence that the Zwinglians adopted, as opposed to the real presence and the sacramental nature that Luther emphasized. And so Protestants on the continent were deeply Cranmer very deliberately adopts what seems kind of mediating language. When you read the Book of Common Prayer, you'll read what it says about the supper in one place and think, now that sounds sort of like memorialism. And then you read it somewhere, think, that sounds very much almost like transubstantiation, right? And Anglican practice has that kind of diversity. There's where a discussion of something being high and low church makes a lot of sense. Right? Because my brother always talked about high church Episcopalians, he said they always have the red doors. It's funny, in our area that actually was true. More cathedral life, but could have even services of benediction of the sacrament. But remember, on the other end of the spectrum, the Wesleys came out of the Episcopal Church, and they themselves were never something separate. All right, so method, that's the other end of Anglican practice. And what is to be the binding thing? What they're trying to create in this country. Remember, England is sort of really becoming a people now. In a way that before you had these rival factions, now they're trying to sort of build a national identity, and the English church is part of that. That if they share a common liturgy, and what they did in private, maybe one thing, but when they worship publicly, there were sanctions against both clergy and parishioners if they use other than these services from the Book of Common Prayer.
You say England, did that include all the British Isles?
Yes, although they don't have them. See, I mean, what you read, so that it really is England. What happens later is the English Empire builds, then this does spread. Right, so the point then here is that in a way, so we know, for example, that some of the Catholic nobility that remained, that they had Catholic chaplains in their home. But think about it. What would happen over a generation if you weren't allowed to worship publicly? If you shared these kinds of common language, I think it would build a sense of yourself as a people. And the role of the Book of Common Prayer, I think, cannot be overestimated in what it, and that's why what have been the two big things that have divided Episcopalians in this century? It was the new recension of that Book of Common Prayer. They did a new edition and they updated the language. And many of them just went ballistic, and the ordination of women. Now, Lutherans got very upset about their hymnal too. But let's face it, how many of us could really have sort of recited the SBH in such a way that we shed big crocodile tears when the wording shifted? But the Book of Common Prayer is different in that way. It's a significant piece to what formed the English language. And it is quite beautiful. Quite beautiful. I mean, I talked to someone who mentioned my mother yesterday, who commented at one point that she was communioned out. Another time, she embarrassed me. She's getting back at me. I just feel it for all the things I did to her as a child. But it's innocent. My grandmother died. And my grandmother was taken up to New Jersey for burial. She'd been a widow for 50 years, and her husband was buried up there. And the pastor of our home congregation said he would be happy to go up. And of course, my mother, oh, no, I don't want to trouble you. Just you can find somebody up there. So we had a Lutheran pastor in Glen Rock, and we went to see him before the funeral. You know, and all this. And my mother looks at him and says, and I don't want you to preach. And I want to say, Mom, you can't tell a pastor that you don't want that. I kept thinking, what? Where is this coming from? You know, and of course, instead of just shutting up and letting my mother mourn and handle this in her own way, I tried to cover it up, which was because later on, when I was talking to her, trying to figure that out, she just wanted the service read. Well, of course, the thing is, one of the things in the Book of Common Prayer is that it's a beautiful service. Lovely readings from Scripture. It's read, and they didn't preach because at the grave, all people are equal, and the tendency of a pastor or a minister to distinguish between high and low born meant that you read those straightforward words of promise and hope. Well, that's how people in my mother's family were buried. Say. And under the circumstances, considering this man didn't know my grandmother at all, and how wonderfully complex the relationship was, but painful, might be better if we hadn't. Because it was a little too hygienic for the truth. You know that that feeling you have sometimes at funerals where you go up and look in the box and say, is this who I think it is? Well, but that was our fault for making a total stranger do it. So, but I mean, those pieces, and there I realized, my uncle, like how the power of those words at given times have just impressed themselves. So that the receptionist and the editing of that book really did rock a lot of people. Now, Edward dies young. He only reigns for about 5 years, and upon his death, interestingly enough, a kind of sense of orderliness, the English then recognized Mary as the next monarch. And it gets very complicated now because Mary is Catholic. And she has the title her father assumed of supreme head. And so what she does is start carrying the English church back to Rome. This is complicated on a number of fronts. One of them is after they took over those church properties, people have gotten those, and they are not eager to have to restore them. Parliament is not happy at the thought of having to pay the annates and tithes and the other things back to Rome that they haven't been doing. People who had left the monasteries are not eager to have to go back. Right? I mean, on a number of fronts, it's very difficult. And one of the largest problems is that Mary is the wife of Philip of Spain. Right? You know, he is the son of the emperor. A member of, I know, it gets, but the big Habsburg family. The point is, the English, who finally have a sense of themselves and of their independence, are very nervous that now they're going to be sort of subsumed under Habsburg political interests. I mean, the Habsburgs are a huge, powerful family. Charles V, by heredity, inherited Spain and the Lowlands. He's elected emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. It's Germany. He has influence. His brothers reigning in Austria and Hungary. They also have claims to territory in northern Italy. They scare people. And that's one of the reasons the Pope is at loggerheads with him. He doesn't want Charles to be at a point where he could conquer the Roman possessions in Italy. So the English now think, now what happens to us? And indeed, they become embroiled in one of the Habsburg skirmishes on the continent, and they lose the last piece of territory they held on the continent of Europe, which is Calais. So they are very unhappy about this, and much to, I mean, it's really probably a blessing that Mary also died young and died childless because it was a collision course. But during her reign, a number of the Protestant leading people have fled to the continent, their so-called Mary exiles. Mary has been called Bloody Mary. And as I think, as scholars have pointed out, you know, she moved slowly, so that people could see what was coming and had time to get out. Now, that doesn't mean, a number of people were worried, and among them Thomas Cranmer was one of his heretics. Yeah, I always wanted to call her Bloody Mary. She's sort of more like smoking. Yeah, I mean, but anyway, so this is the time. Now, when she dies, who's left? Elizabeth. And Edward and Mary have each reigned approximately 5 years. I'm trying to think. She comes to the floor. She's in her 20s. Let's see if I can sum up these dates. She's born. Mary dies, and she comes in 1553, so she's probably about early 20s. Wait, Mary's 1553, 1558. Elizabeth comes to the throne in 1558 and must have been born, I would say, sometime around 15. Now, it's interesting that she has lived. I mean, she sort of lived under house arrest. She's there now. Now, she's going to reign well into the 1600s. And if you think how far England has come, because the Elizabethan age is the age of fear, it blossoms. But Elizabeth, once again, her concern is to hold it together. And so she returns to the kind of church establishment her father had. She changes her title. She's not going to be supreme head, she's the supreme authority. And the reason she does that is for Roman Catholics, the Pope is the supreme head. For the radical Protestants, Christ is the supreme head of the church. So just by avoiding the title, she can sort of stay out of it. She then, again, with the help of Matthew Parker, who becomes her Archbishop of Canterbury, returning from exile, but reestablishes things much on the lines of her father and her brother. Using again the Book of Common Prayer, requiring it. It has again been revised in certain ways to avoid some, you know, not to give offense unnecessarily. And she is really caught, I mean, she demands for herself the recognition, the oath of loyalty. People are really bound to her and to this establishment. But the other thing is that interesting is that Parliament, when she takes over, passes a law that no foreign potentate or prelate, meaning prince, secular or spiritual, will have any authority in the English realm. In other words, they want to avoid the danger they saw with Mary. And in the end, what Elizabeth does is not marry. Right? On the theory that, I mean, as she put it, I'm married to England. But her options, as you can imagine, were limited. If she married a foreign prince, there would be this great concern. And of course, I think she was quite worried that they would try to muscle her out, but that England might also be subject to another country's policies. If she married one of the English nobility, she could upset this balance by favoring one family over another. The irony of this, of course, is that when she dies childless, it is the son of her Roman Catholic rival, Mary Queen of Scots, who is behind James, who then takes the crown of both Scotland and England. Because Elizabeth has no longer succeeded. So, that gives you an idea. Now, when Elizabeth comes, things are shaky. She not only has Roman Catholics who still are unhappy, but she has a crew of vociferous radical Protestants for whom this has not gone far enough. And they break off into various camps. There are some who are happy with the English church, but they just think it hasn't purified itself enough of Romanizing influences. There are others who object precisely to the episcopal structure, which for Elizabeth was a critical piece of the church's identity. They're Presbyterians, they want a structure with elders, they're Congregationalists, right? Some other group who think you shouldn't have any kind of state church at all, but just congregations of committed voluntary believers, that the government shouldn't have anything to do with this. You have independents, right? And eventually, this is the group that produces the Puritans. So, she is trying to hold these together and is forceful on both ends of the spectrum to keep those people in line. Preaching, for example, becomes a big deal. Who's allowed to do it so that these incipient Puritans can't cause her a lot of public embarrassment with their denunciations? So I don't want you to think it was exactly smooth sailing, but I think it's remarkable how things settled enough for England really to flourish in this period. So, that's historical background, and it is a very important part of who, of what the Anglican Church is. But this piece about the bishops is the one that becomes the most pertinent in ecumenical relations. Matthew Parker, now I have never quite understood how this works. We've talked how in the Roman Catholic hierarchy, really the central office is the bishop. The fullness of sacramental ministry and teaching ministry is given to the bishop. The bishop ordains priests who then share in his ministry and act in the various parishes under his care. So that there's the sense of apostolic succession, a belief that Jesus hands down divine truth in written and unwritten forms, and that these teachings are given to the disciples, you see, and so those who stand as their heirs in office. They are a necessary piece to the fullness of what it is for the church to be the church. And this idea of apostolic succession, the laying on of hands, who is endowed with this trust and this charge, and by God's own design granted this power. through the consecration, the right consecration of bishops, the ordination of priests, and not just anybody can do it. Okay. Now, some of these duly consecrated bishops went along with the reform, and I guess what happens is once you're consecrated in this way, you can't take it back, because it's a kind of an ontological, is the word they use, an actual God impresses in this person, which what they'll say about baptism, a change in them, a power in them. Once a person is a priest, he can be excused from duty, but he can't be undone, so to speak. Can't be unordained. Yeah, in a way. So what he has in Matthew Parker is a bishop who fled, but had been duly brought into the apostolic succession. And that means that the bishops in the Anglican Church are. This is precisely why they could make good a claim of being Catholic without obedience to Rome. Because the episcopal structure was linked to the apostolic succession, even though they disagreed with the Roman bishop. Right? So, an important piece of how this church defines who it is the episcopal structure. It is not a matter of options, you know. That's why the people who said, we don't want bishops, we want presbyters. We don't want presbyters, we just want congregational polity, was seen as very threatening. It wasn't just a matter of, oh, well, okay. You organize that way. If they were that, they weren't part of church. So the bishops are very important. Now, what does that mean when we, well, I'm going to take Lutherans because for some of you here, most of you here probably, this is the agreement that stands before us. Lutheran polity is varied. What happened at the time of the Reformation in German lands was that they were hoping the bishops would hear the truth and come over, but they didn't, right? So then when they needed pastors for congregations, these bishops were hardly going to provide them, not the kind they wanted. So eventually, just by default, they bypassed it. And when they see that the hierarchy, remember, this what I said before, I think this is really important, that the kind of core experience of Protestants, Lutherans in particular, is that the very hierarchy at its very heart was what betrayed the gospel. They don't feel that confident about it, right? So what Luther could say is, listen, congregations are in a position to choose, to judge the teaching. They know the gospel when they hear it. So what you have is a kind of a make-do order, and in particular, the Lutheran princes become what they call emergency bishops, in some sense. What fell upon them was the obligation to order and care for the church. Now, they didn't ordain people, but see, they did a lot of the job that bishops should have done because the bishops wouldn't do it. We find in other places later on, we start having episcopal offices in Lutheran churches again. In the Scandinavian countries, particularly, for example, Sweden, when they became Lutheran, they became Lutheran all at once. Everybody became Lutheran. And that meant those bishops did too, and they have been in, you see, apostolic succession. Sweden is one Lutheran country where it still holds. When Bishop Kjellström took over the office of the bishop of the ELC, one of the things that was an issue was that they would invite bishops to come from Lutheran churches around the world and join in the laying on of hands to consecrate. Kurt Kjellström is a Swedish background. So a Swedish bishop would have been a very but people raised the question about, but if the Swedish bishop does it, then is this saying something we don't want to say about apostolic succession? See, because he's in it, and we haven't decided yet. So these are the places it gets a little sticky. The question then for Lutherans, the term that the confessions have used is adiaphora. It's a Greek term. It means things indifferent. And what we say is there are a whole lot of things that fall into the category of traditions, and it's six of one, half dozen of another. If it works well and it supports the gospel, it's okay. And when it stops working well or doesn't, you should change it. It's a thing in and of itself indifferent. But at a critical moment, something that 10 years ago was indifferent suddenly isn't indifferent anymore. So this is the piece. For the Episcopalians to enter into communion for us, with us, They ask of us that we recognize the episcopacy. It will mean that future Lutheran ordinations would have an episcopal bishop present to lay on hands. So that, see, for them, the validity and fullness of the sacramental ministry of the church is connected with who celebrates it and how they stand in this succession. And they ask that of us. Now, there are many Lutherans who think, well, that's fine. We should do that. But frankly, we've lost something not having an episcopal office. And there are other Lutherans who say, that's putting a condition on the gospel. To say you have to have somebody, you have to have a bishop duly consecrated in this succession and priesthood, that says somehow or other, if they aren't there, the gospel isn't the gospel. It's what one of my colleagues refers to as gospel plus. No such thing as gospel plus. Right? And where ordinarily structures adiaphora, if we go along with that, suddenly we're saying it's not. And acknowledging that our sacramental ministry is defective. Now, that frankly is a funny one. This is not one of my colleagues at the seminary. It was one of my former professors who said to me, well, Jane, our sacramental ministry is defective. And I said, well, you sure changed your tune since I was in seminary. It wasn't defective back then. Which is only say that ecumenically, it's how people grow together to begin to say, if our position is such that it would keep us from joining others at the table, then it is defective. And then there are others who say, no, wait a minute, what are we willing to bargain on and at what price? Because how many things are we going to say you have to do for the gospel to be the gospel? Now see, and I'm not going to come down at this point and say who's right and who's wrong. I happen on this one. Part of it is because I sort of said, well, what about people like me? And I thought, oh my gosh, as I read this agreement, you're just waiting for me to retire or die so that you'll have a real full ministry. Because we'd be grandfathered in, as it were, you know, because we'd sort of, but we'd be in this kind of no-man person's land, I mean, kind of in the middle, because we wouldn't have been ordained that way. Then the question came up, well, if Episcopal students are exchanged, do they have to subscribe to the Augsburg Confession? See, our seminary graduates who take up Lutheran pastoral ministry have to pledge themselves. They do in their ordination. There's a Lutheran ordination to teach and preach in accordance with what the Lutheran movement has recognized. And we ask that, does it mean we have to have books of common prayer and green books? You know, in our... So, now, here's the place where the pressure comes, and I think this is a fair one about Lutherans, is everybody says, you know, you guys are always, we'll have a dialogue, we come to ecumenical dialogues, and then when it comes up to doing something, well, I said, you always retreat behind, well, we just can't do that, that would be adding something to the gospel, that we have a reputation of being kind of a tease. You know, I mean, in that way, I think there's some who just feel like, you know, when it would cost you anything, you won't do it. And I think those are very real pieces to look at. So the Episcopalian Concordat is coming up in 95. And look, you can almost see, can't you, the way the church divides between people's wealth and people who are kind of Romanizers, they're in favor of that. And the others, you know, but they're more Protestant, they want to go with the Reform. And of course, we're going to have to deal with both at once and talk about what does it mean to be ecumenical in both directions. How will that look? And of course, if we make this move towards episcopacy, this is a big piece of ecumenical relationships with Rome. Because for the Romans, we can talk, I mean, we've come to some significant agreements about justification, we really have, and some significant understandings about what the sacrament means. But the problematic one still remains, who should celebrate it? Those issues of ministry, of structure, they're there. So let me stop there for questions or comments.
Will this come to women? I mean, the priests don't want women to be priests. I mean, that's what their own problem.
Yes, this is another issue. I mean, I'm not a minor one. Because, now, part of it, this is interesting, with their polity, is a bishop has, you see, had a supreme authority in his diocese, so some bishops do it and some don't. And in the Anglican Communion worldwide, you see, this is, it isn't like where the Pope can just say, no, and no means no, south of the equator, north of the equator, east and west, you know. I mean, no means no. But the Archbishop of Canterbury can't do that in the same way, so that you have, for example, in South Africa, other places, they don't ordain women. And one of the concerns, and here is an ecumenical concern, and I just want to think about what does communion mean? The Anglicans among themselves, can we ask you, in respect for brothers and sisters who are not where you are with this, to think about the effect on them before you do it? And this, that's something we think about, I mean, just intra-Lutheran, but now what does it mean across ecumenical lines? Because we're a done deal. And I think it would mean, that's what I wondered, would it mean if I were in the diocese of an Episcopalian bishop who didn't like it, or a country where they didn't like it, that my ministry wouldn't be recognized?
Or you wouldn't be asked to lay on the hands and all the other things that go with ordinations.
Let me say, a place where this comes up, it's been interesting to me even in Lutheran ordinations, now that I kind of do them, is that even the difference within our community of, when I was ordained, we had a, you know, kind of a down-home bishop in Maryland, and when they did the laying on of hands, he asked my mother and father to come forward, and they were just traumatized, because they didn't think that was their job. That's what Claire, because, and it's just a wonderful division. My mother was so traumatized, she stayed in her seat and made my father go. And he looked so uncomfortable, you know, because he wasn't sure whether they didn't know that he wasn't a pastor. Sort of, and then other, now when I got out to the Midwest and went to ordinations, I mean, that laying on of hands was enough to give this poor ordained man a broken neck. You know, I mean, because there, the custom in the community was all sorts of people who were part of. Now, here's even this question. Where does the authority come from? Does it rise up out of the congregation? Is it some sense of, I mean, so I'm just saying, within our own tradition, we have different views of this.
And we've changed a lot in the years.
So that this kind of demand, ecumenically, vis-a-vis the Anglicans, also brings up to the surface, a fissure that's there for us too.
When we had our ordination, the Episcopal priest from our Olympia area came with the Methodist and Presbyterians all to lay hands on him on his skull. Does that mean that if that one was connected to all this priestly thing, that pastor now has that as part of his ordination?
Well, I would think if the Episcopalian bishop laid hands on him, in a way he is imparting to him, and it's a recognition also of this person then being entrusted to carry out part of that bishop's ministry. Because that's why priests were consecrated by
him. She's two different. You said ordination and installation. An installation might be a different
thing.
Okay.
Thing. But you don't usually lay on hands at an installation.
Not usually. But people do all the
time. I'm just interested in this connection with the Episcopalian and their hierarchy. I mean, you read in history on these hierarchies, and they're more political than they are religious.
Well, I think that kind of division, I mean, again, I'm always careful about imposing that judgment as I read about the things, because I just think the separation of those categories is something that those people didn't make in the same ways. I mean, that, and so the warp and woof of their lives, it didn't seem odd, for, especially for Americans. What Henry VIII did seems very bizarre. But the idea of the separation of church and state is one we'll talk about on Thursday, where it comes out of the Reformation, but it just wasn't the way things were done. And for most people in the world today, I think it still isn't done today. But I think here again is a way to look at this is a question, too, of how they understand God. See, that's why I think when Henry made that claim about being a Catholic church apart from obedience to Rome, that very sort of understanding of God having acted sort of to preserve the teaching office and the fullness of the sacramental ministry by this peace of succession is something that one finds in the Catholic Church, and it is more a way of looking at where you think God sort of anchors God's work. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it just happens to be one that I think particularly for Lutherans is that that core experience in the Lutheran Reformation was that that wasn't trustworthy. And now, but I am very compelled. I mean, when people say, how many of these agreements are you going to make, and when are you going to get off the dime and do? And take the chance. And I think that's a serious one to look at. I don't know how many of you are in congregations where, have any of you looked at these documents or the study documents?
Well, the sex one has kind of taken everything.
Well, how about a nice change? You know, it suddenly, doesn't the Episcopal office seem significantly less threatening?
I mean, in the wake of the human sexuality document, I think this would be kind of an easy thing to talk about. That, but really, before that 95 assembly, if you have a pastor you feel you can bug, or if you just have an adult, yeah, there are some good study documents. The Ecumenical Affairs Office of the ELCA would be happy to direct you to what's there. And sit down and talk about them. And what would be really wonderful, if all you have relations, is get, if you could get a group with people from that, yes, from the other, and sit down and look at this and say, well, what do you make of this? I think it would be remarkably rewarding. You know? Because you learn about a lot about yourselves.
Our choirs went together, saying Easter together, and we've done tons of things with St. John's, and they're just teaching them.
But to read over those documents, they do a good job of study guides of laying out what the issues are, which may not be immediately apparent. The Ecumenical Affairs Office, I think, has a great deal invested in our moving ahead with this one. Yeah.
So all of them are coming up in 95?
Well, not this one will, and the Reformed one will.
Which are kind of related.
Well, they at least put you at, I mean, there's sort of two, it's like facing two sides. People say, we're really going to have to think what it means to be ecumenical when you have two groups where the issues are so, because, I mean, the Reformed are not like wedded to bishops. Whew. You know, I mean, that's, so, and what will it mean? This is that thing I said about if A is B's friend, and A becomes C's friend, do B and C automatically become friends? And there's this piece about, well, if you're willing to do this with us, but you do that with them, and we're not comfortable with that, does that mean you aren't sincere with us? But this is how, I mean, doesn't say we're at a really critical stage now, in some ways, in terms of what they call reception. What is going to happen? And the third piece is that the last meeting of the Ecumenical Affairs Office, they told us that in consultation with Cardinal Ratzinger, who's the one ahead of, I forget what they call it, but the congregation essentially, this is why it says it's the one that used to put people on the index. I mean, but faith, what did they call it? Sort of propagation of the faith?
It's called propaganda.
Well,
good heavens. It's one of those things that didn't always have a derogatory.
Yes, but it is the one that, I mean, the office in the Vatican that is responsible for sort of the preservation of doctrine. And for ecumenical work, that he feels that in the next several years, Lutherans and Catholics will move ahead enough with one another to talk about really lifting the kind of mutual condemnations around the idea of justification. Now, if that came up at the same time, our heads would be spinning. Yeah.
I think when you talk about that A, B, and C business, it's also worth remembering that the further the ELCA goes in those directions, the bigger the gap between the ELCA and the Missouri Lutheran. So that there is this, there's always something to be gained and something to be lost, and is our concern to preserve our own communion? No, if I become friends with so-and-so who my brother doesn't like, and then I lose relationship with my brother, what does that mean? So that there are prices and gains on all sides, and they aren't all just across confession alone.
I will say at this point, I think, I don't even think about Missouri. partly because I think they've written us off.
Well, I can't have that communion there if I confess that I'm not Missouri, and I can't have the Episcopal Church.
Basically, they use this, I mean, they would block this in a way. I mean, there's, at the times, that was one of the other ecumenical dialogues you could put on, is asked to come down for a day to deal with, and I realized that it in a way, I don't know that anything we do or don't do will make any difference for them sorting this out. But I think that's a good point. My history is such that they're awash for me. I had less to do with Missouri than with any other group in my hometown. They wouldn't even send somebody to my ordination, you know, and or acknowledge the invitation, you know, and all that. I mean, so, but that's, my history's different. Many Lutherans' history is deeply intertwined with Missouri, and the wounds are big, so that's a good point. They know that this is seen as just making that gulf bigger and bigger.
If I could approach it from the other end, now that the Episcopal Church is moving more toward your position relative to the ordination of women, now that the Church of England has started that process as the basically the leader to the Archbishop of and the United States has been going to the front to the point of even ordaining a female bishop. That's putting us farther from Rome, and at least John Paul has made it clear that that is going to create even more difficulty and ecumenism between Rome and
Anglicans.
I mean, where do you see that process going? Because it's moving the Episcopals farther away from the ability to reunite or to unite with Rome.
Well, one of the things I find interesting is that given, as I would understand, Episcopal teaching about the office of the bishop and the sacramental ministry, the fact that they can ordain women says something about being able to use an understanding that has great similarity with Catholics without putting the restrictions on it that Rome has. And in my crudest moments, I'll tell you, I think it could be as different as it did Pope. See, I mean, that is one of the awkward things about Roman, is that this is what John Paul thinks. This is not what lots of Roman Catholics think at all.
Is there?
And so let me say that some Roman Catholics see precisely this movement as actually helping them, because they too, I mean, we all get sort of caught in the tides of ecumenism. So I think that's an interesting one. I'll tell you, the other place I think it smarts a little bit is that people have said, you know, perhaps the Catholic Church in America could do what the English Church did.
Split up.
But this might happen.
When I was in college, I said that the Catholic Church was split away from Rome before the Berlin Wall fell. I have a Catholic friend that called me and said he lost. You know, because I thought both of them were impossible.
Yeah.
And you know, one happened, so might not the other one, because we've been arguing about that since the 60s.
So that's a good point, and it's hard. This is, again, that other question, who is the church? You know, you talk to so many Roman Catholics who think that it's quite foolish that they don't allow clergy to marry. And that some of the greatest talent and commitment in their church comes from women who find vocations and serve faithfully, and could have a sacramental ministry, and it would not be offensive to them. You know what, you're right. It may make the gulf bigger. It may be the thing that at some point lets us move forward. It's not something clearly that we can undo, although there are women in the ELCA who are often nervous that some of our brothers in particular who are eager to advance relationships in Rome would not find us an exorbitant price to pay.
What's interesting to me, at least a little confusing maybe, you've been talking about here and these things that are going to be taken up by the major church in 95, but I don't really think they've been even discussed in our church congregation, not even really in the Southwest Washington Synod discussion. We talked about a lot of other minutiae, but we didn't even address this.
Well, let me say, the thing is, because it's 2 years, I do think the study process that's part of, you know, the sad thing is money is such a problem in the ELCA right now, that even getting a study guide written and published so it's available, I mean, it's really heartrending that they can't get those things out.